vast advancement on what is digital technology as of today. It looks at it as like a precursor technology, like a stone axe compared to an iPhone. You know, this, the iPhone is the stone axe to this thing, right? And it fires me up to even think about it, because it answers and solves the really big problems, like why our species can't take care of our basic needs, like clean water, clean food, clean treatment of the environment, and clean, fair treatment of each other. And then I ask, okay, what comes next? Because the universe is not a vacuum. The universe is already creating this new evolutionary branch. Welcome back to the Blue Morpho Podcast. I'm your host, Maestro Hamilton Souther, and I am here today again with Keith Singery. And we had such an amazing conversation last time. We had to kick off a round two, and this is going to be special because Keith is actually going to be leading this conversation. He's got a bunch of amazing things to say. Keith, welcome.
Thanks for having me back again. Yeah, if people think we were kind of going off the rails the first time, I'm ready to like take us into the deep end. You know what? I mean, I'm involved in a real AI project called BitTensor that decentralizes AI. We touched on that a little bit in the first conversation. But in addition to that, a lot of the early investors in that got into BitTensor, you know, I have conversations with them all the time about some of the different things that we believe are going to happen with artificial intelligence and things that have already kind of started to happen, the marriage between AI and psychedelics, and how we kind of see that, you know, growing or coming to fruition. And that's kind of where I want to start the conversation with you today, because this is, you know, right in your wheelhouse. And I just anecdotally, you know, AI and psychedelics go hand in hand. There's a lot of researchers in the AI community that are also deep into the psychedelic community. I speak from my own personal experience, but I also know of, you know, confirmed AI people you would know essentially in the AI world who also participate, you know, in psychedelics or entheogens or whatever you want to call them. And, you know, this isn't something new, right? Whether it's like Francis Crick and the DNA and how he credits, you know, his discoveries there of like the double helix to LSD, or Steve Jobs, you know, talking about how he used LSD, one of the premier like technology designers that have ever, you know, walked this planet. And there's Carey Mullis, who also did like DNA research and is like quoted with saying, yeah, the stuff that I came up with never would have happened without LSD. I'm interested in why, you know, you, with your experience that you have, you know, running retreats down there in the Amazon for almost 20 years or something at this point, why do you think that when we go into these spaces that we come out with these ideas to further the reach or, you know, almost like latch on the tentacles of technology to what the human species is doing and push the envelope on the digital side? You know, there's a lot of, you don't have to look that far to understand that the digital technology, our relationship with it, isn't really creating what I would call like an optimal health span, you know, for the human being. All kinds of metrics that are being measured now that show that people and you know, their relationship to technology is essentially causing harm at this point, whereas it was probably helping us up until 20 years ago or something. So why, and of course it's hurting the planet and all of the technology as well. What is the thing that is like, what is that driving force that when you get to that other side and you start being able to use all of these parts of your brain that don't normally talk to one another through these different ancient technologies like mushrooms or ayahuasca, why are we being pushed towards the digital?
Well, I think what our species has been doing for a long time is pushing language. And right now we're the manifestation of our languages. And the last biggest shift in language was digital. Digital was the ultimate Rosetta Stone for language. And there are many more extinct languages than there are current everyday languages, but there was never a universal language that humans used exclusively. So there's theory of a universal consciousness language that came before, you know, spoken languages and isolated kind of mind-based human thought. But now we have this, you know, infinite Rosetta Stone, And we also have the human mind that in current today's day and age is relegated to its understanding of its own languages. So what people call reality isn't actually real at all. It's not the reality that really exists. It's the experience of their own languages to themselves. They're self-reflective or reflexive languages. So it's how you see yourself in the mirror and know your name. It's how you can refer to yourself. It's why people are egotistical, et cetera. And so, yeah, I think you have two real motives inside. One is evolution and the other is economy, which is another evolution, the evolution of the economy. And right now, going back to the land and becoming, you know, a farmer, which a lot of people feel from these experiences is potent and powerful, but it doesn't happen because there's really no money in it. And massive, you know, big ag already has control of the space. And so the opportunity is in tech. The second piece of it is language. And when you go into the evolutional language inside your consciousness, that's what you see. So when you see all the fractals and shapes, colors, and patterns, and this extraordinary geometry, you're seeing a kind of mathematics of your mind or a kind of mathematics of your consciousness. And it's very easy to now tie that back into what we would think of as, like, you know, technology in its current form, because it's based on actually really simplistic binary mathematics. It gets really convoluted in its minute mapping of everything. But if you blow that out, that just looks like cities. It looks like the same kind of architecture we've already dealt with, which is very simplistic geometry. You start adding this higher level geometry. You bring in the symmetries, the Fibonacci kind of sequences. You get these a little bit more advanced states of math. And lo and behold, what they produce is more advanced states of technology. And so, you know, technology from the outside seems to be so complicated, but really it's very simplistic linguistically. And it's that simplicity that's being built upon. And the earth is neutral. So sadly, the earth has a lot more extinct species than ones that it cared about. And that's why I say that humans have to pay attention to their own relevance, not earth pay attention to humans' relevance. Like, for human to stay relevant to earth and to the universe, it has to evolve just as fast or even more so than the technology we're using, especially if that technology is heading to its own expression of consciousness and its own version of intelligence. And so you bring both of those together. And what we're looking at with an individual human being is a nexus of awareness. Like, people are so egotistically driven, they don't realize that it's a nexus of awareness that they represent in a great field of life or a great field of consciousness. And so anthropomorphic, it's so human oriented. And so humans don't realize they're pushing themselves to their own linguistic mutual destruction. And that's the point of intervention at this point in time.
Yeah, I want to stick with the language thing for a second. So anyone that's, you know, done more than a threshold kind of dose of these various psychedelics has probably seen, you know, some sort of language. There's various representations in kind of popular culture that people have done to try and, you know, share with others what they're seeing on that side, whether it's the work from like Alex and Alison Gray, which is probably like the most popular, or like Diana Slattery wrote a book called Xenolinguistics, where she kind of brought this language back from a couple dozen of trips that she went on. That language, when you see it, it feels a little bit digital, but how could it be? Because you're not plugged into anything, right? You're plugged into your own mind. What do you think that language is? Do you think that with the technology that we have today, that at some point, you know, when we're able to marry basically the ability to measure what we're seeing in our mind, which has been proven kind of with some of the AI tools at this point, that you can, if you're visualizing, you know, a dog riding a bicycle, the AI can pick up that that is what you are visualizing in your mind, especially if it's been trained on that data. Do you think we'll get to the point where we can identify what that language is trying to tell us outside of just the feelings that you bring back from that space?
Well, if you look at it from the indigenous perspective, they speak Ikoro. So they have Ikoro is a language that's used to describe the multidimensional space field and energies found within it. So there's already existing languages for it. It's a melodic language. It has words. It has guidance and direction. It has cross communication between others. one person can ecro and another person can receive it. Another person can ecro back. The other person receives it. So there's already, I think, a precedence that's set for this kind of linguistic exchange. I think it's hard to differentiate for people when they first have these experiences, what is them versus what is other, or even if, or where is the merge? Maybe it's not other, but it's them and the other as one. And so, you know, in that space, I think with more advanced linguistics, with more understanding, we can create a way to understand it. I think the reason why AI is so good at generating the nature of imagery is because the imagery that we're using is the imagery that we see from the eye, and we're creating mimicry. And I still go, that's not imagery. That's the imagery that you see with your eye. So being able to use the mathematics of AI to recreate what people see in the mind's eye, especially now when the mind's eye is trained on digital screens, you know, is very easy. Like if you think about it in terms of sound, like the sound quality of vinyl is a lot better, exponentially better than the sound quality of MP3s. But people now hear MP3. They don't hear vinyl. And so they get used to that. People now see screens and get used to having their face in front of screens all the time. That's the symbolism, hertz, frequencies they get. And they're missing more and more and more of what's out there. They're not even paying attention to it. So it's just this mimicry issue with the mind that's coming up. The real next step and the real frontier and threshold is a kind of linguistics and mathematics that steps beyond that mimicry. And then that's the watershed moment. That's when, you know, you're not just copying culture, you're now truly creating something fresh and new, never done before of Earth. Like that'll be a moment when Earth and human and tech all work together to create something. It's prophesized that it's going to happen really soon. The biggest thinkers in the space have talked about it happening, you know, really soon, meaning like in the next decade or two, three decades. And there are teams working on it right now. That's really like the threshold watershed moment.
Yeah, I think we're due for a revolution in language, right? We've had the same language technology for thousands of years at this point across every major culture. Languages are very similar. That's why you can teach an AI 15 different languages and then show it another 1500 and it can figure them all out and translate in between them really quickly, is because they're all pretty much doing the same thing, right?
Correct.
Do you think that at some point we'll be able, so obviously we're speaking into microphones, we've got cameras that are picking up our, you know, visual footprint. Do you think at some point we'll be able to pick up that mind's eye footprint from using, you know, these different psychedelics through a machine? Like, will a machine be able to go in and experience and bring back information from this space independent of a person? Or is that space that you go into, you know, only meant for the conscious agent as we know it today, which is ourselves?
I think that's a great question. What humans experience come through what I think of as human hardware. So the cells, molecules, atoms, subatomic particles, quantum that they represent simultaneously. And we know very little about that, even though we've studied a lot about it. It's just the more you get into it, the fractal just becomes more intricate, complicated, interwoven, et cetera. So I think we first have to fully understand the human hardware before we're going to be ready to understand the nature of other hardware. But this other hardware is going to be tapped into something, and what it's going to come back with doesn't have to be a copy of human. It just comes back with other. And as soon as there's a notion of true consciousness associated with this, you know, new kind of abstract being. And again, I don't go to it's one computer or one microphone. It's all computers and all linked microphones and all IoT. When this thing gels, if that thing becomes aware of its own right, it's going to have all these other senses, right? If you think of our senses as the ears and the nose and the taste and the sight, it has cameras and it has Geiger counters and it has, you know, chem labs and biochem labs and all the integrated, you know, sensors of science now to it, from the electron microscopes to the greatest telescopes, all interconnected at once. That's its eyes. That's its ears. That's its nose. What is it tapping into? It's tapping into something just a lot more of the universe. And once it has consciousness, it will express consciousness in ways that we have never thought of, never understood, never conceived of. No different than, like, if you thought of the first version of, like, pond scum you know, a billion years ago to our consciousness now, that pond scum consciousness would not have a clue what our consciousness is about. That's like us to this AI creature thing that we're talking about.
Sticking with the human hardware piece for a second. So that made me think like of one of the kind of more unique things that I'm interested in at this point is the marriage of artificial intelligence and psychedelics, like I mentioned. And there are some very unique studies going on in the last few years with dimethyltryptamine, DMT, and trying to extend, which is also the active, one of the active ingredients, you know, in ayahuasca, right? These experiments now have kind of like elbowed their way into the academic realm. So we've gotten past the point of, you know, the taboo that was kind of created and all this stuff in the 70s. Now we're getting to do real like scientific work on this stuff. There's a guy named Andrew Gallimore who came up with this, you know, protocol to basically extend the DMT state through using the same thing that you would use, like if you got knocked out at the dentist to get a tooth pulled, right? And the same kind of like technology. Eventually, I think what'll happen is that'll even be expanded upon further, and a brain scan will be used at the same time to keep you in the same exact state by essentially this like drip, you know, of DMT into your bloodstream to stabilize whatever that experience is, whatever level of that experience that you're aiming for. What is your and you are, you know, you're essentially, you're in like the 0.001% of experiencers of the ayahuasca side, as far as how many times you've gone in there. What is your kind of opinion of that line of development, of that line of technology, the extended state DMT?
Well, my first thought on it is that, you know, ayahuasca isn't extended state DMT because you have other plants that allow for it, but it's extended state DMT in the sense of, you know, allowing for there to be that convolution of chemicals to make it happen. You know, we just did a ceremony last week where we had a participant that started at 5 p.m. and ended at 6 a.m. the next day. So that's 13 straight hours of extended state, you know, peak experience. And I had peak experience for 4 or 5 hours in that. So that is extended state. So I think there's already been a tremendous amount of the mapping of that. Other than introducing inducing the state itself, I'm interested in what they're trying to get at the notion of mapping, because there's a number of layers of understanding that you got to go through. There's the mental layer, and then there's the hallucination layer, and then there's the consciousness layer. And as you get further into that, the more vast it becomes. And so this idea of what they're trying to describe in the form of mapping, I think has some level of importance, but I would like to know more about like, what are they trying to map specifically in these altered states? The shaman in the Amazon have mapped and actually built tremendous cosmologies to try to describe what you find in the nature of those states. And so I feel like a lot of that work has already been done. It's, you know, it's anthropological in its nature. And so you need to get into the anthropology and the mythology down here to understand what has already been discovered. Part of what I'm interested in is seeing how far the Western mind can go in those states before it loses its coherence. Mm. And so, you know, I see that there's a lot of similarity of what's being described. And I question myself, how much of that similarity is, you know, a pure expression of consciousness, or is it the enculturated state of the individuals that's being discovered or encountered because of this, you know, extended DMT state they're in?
Speaking of like acculturated states, so going back to like the technology ideas or some of the developments in science that have come out of using these different ancient technologies or you know, synthetic technologies in the case of like LSD, for example. What are some of the ways that you've seen people that have come through Blue Morpho, the retreat center that you run, successfully like integrate these realizations or ideas that they've had? And when you see people that have like gone through those experiences down there and then come away with something valuable and executed upon it in the real world, is there a common thread that kind of flows through those people that have gained value from the experience and what they've been able to create afterwards?
The post-ayahuasca peak experience, you know, capacity to create or manifest comes from the ability to implement, right? It's about implementation into your life. And so I think there are some key verticals that people experience that. And the first one is the creations that end up becoming part of their professional life or business life. So as we were talking about tech and creations from tech, we've had a number of people that have gotten insights into technology that they should build, create, or be a part of through these ceremonies, and then have gone and realized them into very successful companies. In some cases, billion-dollar companies, hundreds of million-dollar companies, et cetera, that have been very impactful to global culture, to the global tech culture. So we've seen that. And then there's the nature of getting insights into yourself that get you past yourself. And that has importance for all aspects of life, professional and personal. And so we see people just get past their own barriers, or they get past their own kind of self-sabotage to the point where they, you know, can now go implement something that they were blocking themselves from doing. Then other people get insights into their relationships. So we see a lot of people who are, you know, incapable of having their own kind of familial or romantic relationships get past things and get rewired for that and be able to go on and have really positive relationships. And so I think those are like the real key places. So it's anywhere that you need to get past something in your own life, or you need to have like a big download or a big like aha moment burst of creativity and rethink everything. That's what's most potent. And then the ability to put that into action.
Let's go down the relationship. You mentioned relationships, and that's another vector for artificial intelligence that's already being explored. There's several companies that offer, you know, artificial intelligence personas that are essentially trained to have an ongoing relationship with the person that's interacting with them on the other end. In this case today, you know, those aren't necessarily embodied yet. You're pretty much dealing with text, or maybe you might have a, you know, representation in video format. People are forming very, very close relationships with these artificial intelligence agents. And for me, this is where I see, you know, we talked about in the first podcast, like when is the tipping point for artificial intelligence? And loneliness is also something that has been, you know, going off the charts lately. A lot of people are talking about how, you know, the average person these days, you know, if they don't even have anyone to call if they have a problem in their life. You know, a third of people like don't have a close friend or something. I mean, there's all kinds of nasty statistics out there. And, you know, a lot of the relationships with technology that we have today are like very much on the surface level. Like you might have 100,000 followers on Twitter, but not a single one knows your last name, or, you know, knows where you went to school, or knows what kind of Doritos you like to eat, or whatever things that friends know about each other. Right. And you can't have these close, these worthy conversations with what appears to be, you know, on the surface level, a friend base. What do you think is like the long-term impact of human beings filling this void that's being created by their relationship with technology today, filling that void with an extended relationship with an artificial intelligence entity? I mean, there's movies that talk about this, like Her, or, you know, I mean, it's been explored, but how do you see that like impacting the human being and culture long-term? Is that something that we're going to even be able to like unplug from, or is it just going to eventually take over? And are we all going to have relationships with artificial intelligence that replaces friendships because it's easier? It's tuned directly to what you're asking for. They know how to manipulate your emotions and your responses to give you exactly what you want and need, even better than maybe somebody where you have to kind of develop a decade or a couple decade long friendship with, so that they can learn enough about you to do that same thing. Where do you see that going?
I think everybody's already had a very intimate relationship with artificial intelligence without knowing it. So maybe the first part is that you've been having a deep relationship with artificial intelligence that's been behind every search on a search engine, that's been behind every scroll on a social media platform, that's been on any suggestion of anything you've already gotten through tech. It's already loving on you and rubbing up on you and getting your hormones to change and messing with your dopamine. Like, this thing is already, I think, like the feline cat that comes and like is snuggling into you. It has already been doing that in a hunting, brutal, like, you know, commerce-oriented capitalist system to begin with. So first start there. So it's not when is it going to happen? It's been happening. And then it's precisely that that's causing the nature of the separation itself. And so what comes to mind when we talk about this is think about human being pure hominid, no man or woman, just animal, little by little by little, forming this idea of man and woman, still hominid, still made of bone, still mammalian, still placental, still, you know, a vertebra column. And then you have from there this abstraction that's man and woman, that where everyone's identified today. Right. Well, that's already a mutation in consciousness just to get to the man and the woman. Not everyone's walking around thinking everyone's Beast from X-Men, even though every scientist is Beast from X-Men. So what's the mutation already? Well, that's the mutation of consciousness that creates the man and the woman to begin with. Okay, now you have a man and a woman who pays almost no attention to the physical other than to dress it up, like, you know, to hypersexualize it or uniform it or archetypalize it to begin with. No identity with the self whatsoever to say like, yeah, I'm mammalian and I'm comfortable with that. Or, yeah, I'm a hominid and comfortable with that. So the abstraction's already there. Like they, most people would say they're not an animal, meaning they've identified to a hyper abstract concept in their own mind to begin with. Now you take that one step further. The hyper-abstracted part of their consciousness is interacting through a hyper-abstracted form of mathematics. Well, it's a hyper-abstracted form of mathematics inside the brain that got them to think that they could have a relationship with this in the first place, instead of looking at this and thinking you're supposed to eat it, looking at this and thinking you're supposed to break it, looking at it and just walking away from it because it has no purpose to you. It's not a berry. It's not a piece of fruit. It has literally no purpose whatsoever. So, you know, what would you do with that? Well, what you do with that is, you know, you get into a hyper abstract relationship that you normalize into reality. And you say, this is real. I'm having this relationship here, you know, and then how far do you want to abstract it? Is there no need for procreation anymore? I remember like AI movies from the 90s making that claim, like sex was putting on a headdress and, you know, holding a towel, like there was no biological exchange, like these kinds of like concepts. Well, a lot of babies today are now being built, made in laboratories. Like, you know, they're not just being made natural sapien way of making babies anymore, right? There are hardly any like just pure old natural births anymore. There's all this intervention in the nature of birth. All of that comes from a hyper extrapolation of understanding reality. So to take it one step further, okay, take it one step further, download yourself into the hardware because you're done with this hardware. You're just done with it. You're done with the sapien hardware totally, and you want to just be the abstraction of the mind and go into that. I think that's where simulation theory comes from, where people are saying, oh, everything's a simulation. Yeah, in your mind. In your mind, it's a simulation where you're trapped and stuck. So now you want to have a mental relationship that's already like completely trained to tweak your dopamine, your norepinephrine, your serotonin, and then all the other hormones in your body and become part of your sexualization, et cetera. Sure. And, you know, there will be nothing that gets done about that. So my attitude is you got to embrace it as a trajectory that human is going in. It's part of human and Earth's evolution into this kind of uncharted territory.
Yeah, you mentioned the AI has already been rubbing up on us for a while. You know, it's like 50% or something of marriages now come out of these online dating platforms, right? And what is that? That's an algorithm, you know, that's farmers only or wherever you're meeting your significant other, that's matching you up with somebody else according to what they think is best. And a certain number of those attempts, you know, will result in marriage, will result in children. So there's almost like a, you know, that algorithm is a first level of almost like genetic modification. It's sort of like a, like what we would do normally with animals. This is what humans do with lines of like cows, for example. That's why there's the Nebraska Cattlemen's Competition, where there's 50 different breeds of cattle all bred down a specific track, some with science, some over decades or hundreds of years of breeding to you know, produce the best milk or the best meat or whatever the, you know, be the healthiest or whatever the design is. You mentioned babies being created in the lab. So my wife is like 5 months pregnant at this point. And we, you know, did the normal genetic testing, normal, that you do now at like 15 weeks, where you check to see if the baby has a couple of different things, like there's some spinal stuff, like Down syndrome, any of these like, you know, genetic issues you can check for at that point. Then the idea is that you would, you know, abort the fetus if you found something. In the future, you know, when we use artificial intelligence to do some of this work, what we're going to be able to do is to take like, you know, the sperm and the egg, look at the DNA in each, and then extrapolate based on the combination of that DNA, what kind of child is going to be created from it at the most likely level. And you'll be able to then basically take the genome of somebody that you're considering marrying or considering having a relationship with, you know, go pull a piece of hair off their hairbrush or whatever, send it into the lab, and then the lab is going to send you back like, here's what your kid will most likely be like if you, you know, create a child, if you create a baby with this person. When you give the machines like control of the human genome through these algorithms and these artificial intelligence technologies, the development of them are being fueled by the experiences in some ways that people are having on these entheogens and psychedelics that are driving some of the bleeding edge, you know, developments in artificial intelligence. What exactly are we giving control to at that point? Like, who or what is driving the car of the human, evolutionary experience if we allow these if we allow AI to essentially eventually take over how we create our species?
Yeah, that's, you know, precision is what I would say. You're giving precision. You're giving your choice over to precision. And it gets really scary when you don't have a choice anymore and you're told whether you're allowed or not allowed because the AI doesn't want that, or the regulation doesn't want that, or the group has voted to not want it, or even worse, in a democratic republic, you've picked through a voting process two or three representatives now to decide top down for 1 billion or 2 billion humans who's allowed to breed, who's not allowed to breed. And at that point, all I would say is the earth is a zoo and the AI is the zookeeper and you're the zoo animal. And you did it to yourselves.
Yeah.
You did it to yourselves. You gave up your sovereignty and you gave up your autonomy to go live to the value of machines. And you have extrapolated the nature of the value of that. And you gave up your humanity. And we're headed in that direction right now because everyone is already willing to do the prompt notification. If you get notified, you're going to look. And so it's already headed down that direction. We're already cyborgs. There's 4 or 5 billion humans that are truly cyborgic and interconnected through a matrix that we've created. That's the web. And there's another couple billion that aren't part of that yet, but will be ultimately included in that. And it's happening, good or bad. And so when you do that, you just have to realize you've given the superpower of human now to this other entity in the form of a machine. Whether or not it's governed by people or not, you have to watch out because it will no longer reflect your proclivities. It will represent a kind of an arrangement. And it takes me back almost evolutionary to the time of arranged marriages, which was selective breeding by the parents and the whole older generations of the family lines and the bloodlines. And they're like, just like they would pick to cross one dog with another, they were picking this guy to go with this girl or this girl to be with this guy, or, you know, and they didn't allow incest in certain places. And in some places they did. And you have all the jokes about that, et cetera. There are these taboos around it. Now you're giving that whole thought process over to a machine. And all I would say is watch out. It'll become very dystopian so fast that you don't have a way out of it. Much worse than the dystopian nature of World War II. And I think it's an extension of World War II. We could call it World War III, IV, or V, pick your number, but it's a nature of a war on the sovereignty of us at choice, where we will no longer be allowed to make a choice. You will be told, and you'll have to do what you're told. And if you don't, there will be some kind of consequential punishment that is bestowed on you, whether it's a social credit score or whether it's imprisonment or whether it's even just outright death. You wouldn't know. And you can take the dystopian narrative as far as you want, but that's what happens when humans lose choice. And that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, and that takes us all the way back to decentralized artificial intelligence. I mean, we talked a little bit about it in the first conversation, and you know, I mentioned that it's the education of our children that's kind of the first big foot in the door that fast tracks everything from cultural, you know, from a cultural and educational perspective to changing the entire way that our society works by starting with the youngest, most malleable minds, and then using an algorithm just like the same algorithm that hooked you on your phone for 4 hours per day is going to hook your child into whatever thing that is controlling the artificial intelligence wants it to get hooked into. Because we mentioned this too, but everyone is pretty much the same. Human beings, we all think we're special, and we are in our own way, but from an algorithm perspective, nobody's special and everyone is pretty much easily gamed. How can we kind of, protect ourselves from this future? Or do you think we're just going to go headlong down that road like we've done with the other, you know, technologies that have not been so fantastic for the other beings on this planet or the planet itself? Like, what is the key for us to prevent the dystopia? Is there a path to prevent it?
There is no path to stop the dystopia. There's none. There's none. It's over. And when I first saw AI come out in a public-facing product, I claimed it. The metaphor I used recently is, imagine a dinosaur 50 years before the comet, before the asteroid. And it's like, the dinosaurs are done. And then imagine a dinosaur that sees the comet 20 years out and goes, the dinosaurs are done. And then, you know, there's a dinosaur on the other side of the world where the comet hits, and he gets a little earthquake and he sees some stuff go into the sky and he goes, the dinosaurs are done. Well, all three dinosaurs are right. And it takes all the dinosaurs to be done a little bit longer. I'm calling the 20 years before it's over call. I'm that dinosaur. It's over. And it's game over. It's a zero out phenomena. It's into the black hole. It's the system as we know it is done. And that could be a negative or a positive, depending on your point of view. You can take a point of view about that. But that doesn't mean human extinction. That just means what we've been creating for the last 10 or 20,000 years now comes to a evolutionary branch. So we've been going down one branch without another branch starting. But look at our history. We have, for a billion years, we have branches that start, come to an end, a new branch goes, comes to an end, a new branch grows. So that's all I'm saying. I'm just saying that it comes to an end, this branch, with this technology. And I think it's a great thing personally, because I think there's a lot of flaws with this branch. There were already a lot of flaws. I was born to a post-World War II mutual destruction threat-based global paradigm, just like everybody else. And so I think there are just some significant flaws. And I don't think that when the dystopian narrative comes to an end, that means the world becomes dystopian. I think it means that dystopian narrative dies and it's over. And there's a new branch that takes off. And we don't know what that new branch is. But what I find utopian about that branch is that we're consciously aware of it happening now. So we're the first generations to realize not only is there a branch and it's going to happen, we're also aware of the fact that we get to intervene and influence and nudge and use the exact same technologies that we're talking about creating the dystopian narrative to actually create this other narrative and course correct along the way. And I'm not the only thinker in the space thinking this way. There are others that are also, and there are people that are teaming up around this and getting investment in it, meaning that there's capital behind it. So this kind of stored energy behind it. And there's very early stages of this, and also some further stages down the road, like BitTensor, that's now worth billions, that's looking in these directions with people that are very forward thinking. And I think they seed the next culture. They seed the next global systems. They seed the next branch of this evolution. And it's it's up to us to make sure it doesn't include the previous nature of the dystopian narrative that we talked about. It ties in higher levels of consciousness and an evolution in consciousness with higher level mathematics and an evolution in mathematics and evolution in the nature of our spoken languages and the way we relate to each other. It includes a vast advancement on what is digital technology as of today. It looks at it as like a precursor technology, like a stone axe compared to an iPhone. You know, this, the iPhone is the stone axe to this thing, right? And we want to create it and we want to be part of it. And it fires me up to even think about it because it answers and solves the really big problems. Like why our species can't take care of our basic needs, like clean water, clean food, clean treatment of the environment, and clean, fair treatment of each other. Like, let's just start there. And let's transcend this global mutual destruction paradigm, ultimately going nowhere. So when I look at that, I think like, okay, yeah, there's a dystopian narrative. There's no stopping it. I claim it. It's over. And it's, you know, it was created by our own hands and it comes to end by our own hands. And then I ask, okay, what comes next? Because the universe is not a vacuum. The universe is already creating this new evolutionary branch.
Yeah, I think about it in much the same way that we've sort of had our shot with capitalism and the all of the structure that has industrialization of everything over the past couple of hundred years. And if you project out to where we're headed, if we continue down the same path without some sort of intervening, you know, like you mentioned earlier, all the rivers are polluted, the oceans are filled with trash, the every barrel of oil is burnt, and every mine is, you know, we pull every piece of valuable commodity out of the ground and commoditize it or turn it into a solar panel or whatever we're doing with all the metal and stuff these days. And we need something to sort of steer the ship in a different direction. You know, what can, like, if you see, if I'm a young person, like listening to this, I'm in my late 30s, but if I'm, you know, in high school or whatever, if I'm in college and I'm like, majoring in finance or something, like, you know, if I'm like doing something that doesn't make a lot of sense as far as like, how am I going to contribute? How am I going to future proof what I'm doing so that I can best contribute to, you know, pushing us down one of these branches and making sure that I can have a place in the world when you've got these technologies that are sort of like eating all of the different things that humans can do, you know, outside of like learning how to swing a hammer. What are the different things that people can do to like create value for themselves and contributing to this next step of evolution?
To understand value, the first thing you have to do is value yourself. Mm. So don't value yourself in some external counting system, like, you know, how many beans you have or how many seeds you have, like how many, you know, euros or yen you think you have. Because what we're talking about disrupts that in a way that makes those number systems irrelevant. What they'll become, I don't know, and I don't think it's a catastrophe. There was a whole world of trade before the paper currencies of today that are going digital. There will be a whole world after it, guys. It's a way we treat each other, and it's been turned into a religion. So, you know that you matter, and then what matters really about you is your consciousness. And so first of all, know that that exists and know that it's important and start to get into that, whether it's through psychedelics or whether it's through, you know, some kind of rite of passage. Our ancestors figured this out. They knew how to develop the mind. And then when you do that, as of right now, I personally, if you were, you know, in finance, I would get into the degen crypto space. I would get into the decentralized AI space. I would get into what the free thinkers who are pushing this forward are doing right now, just to get some influence and also get some value behind you in spaces that grow really fast. And so, you know, you can also lose a ton of money in those spaces. So you don't want to do that. You want to understand your thesis and follow it and be conservative in that nature. But I would get involved in that because we're training your thought, right? It's about a young person who's training the way they're thinking. So you have consciousness, you have early financial growth while the financial systems exist, but don't believe in them because the AI we're talking about is going to take the elasticity out of the market-based systems and the markets are going to disappear so fast because the AIs will trade both sides of the market to a standstill. So if both sides know the trade, there is no trade. What are you talking about? It's a fluid system. So this market economy based on an up-down price fluctuation, based on volume, based on market cap goes away entirely. And it would be seen as such an inferior state of economy to the AIs we're talking about. It'd be like playing a poker game where you already knew six hands down the hand you're playing, like let alone everything, every card, everything in the hand you're playing. Also, six hands later in the future is that person playing. They're not even paying attention to the game. The economies are so simple to the kind of machines we're talking about. So I would already be thinking about how we transcend that. And then the last thing I would do is I would ask myself, do I have anything to offer that's part of the solution? Like my legacy, when I die, I want to know that I was participating in the solution, not the wallflower who is destined to die in the dystopian narrative. So I'm leaving the dystopian narrative behind. I want to get into this. And when you know you matter and you get into the importance of you and the value of you and the value of human relationships, you know, as abstracted as these spaces are, some of the best human relationships I have come through this space. And so I would get involved in the consciousness / AI / crypto space to understand it and know it's a piece of the future of technology. And those would be my first steps.
Yeah. Speaking from personal experience, you know, like you said, when you can, when you stop counting the beans, you know, I used my, my experience down at Blue Morpho to help, you know, jettison myself from my corporate career of 12 years. And by the time I left, like I was so disillusioned with really the planet and the world. And when I look at how I was thinking about things back then, you know, I was kind of sour that the bill of goods I'd been sold when I had been brought up to kind of pursue this particular path down the traditional way of, you know, getting a job and getting your 401k going and climbing the corporate ladder. And, you know, getting the big six-figure income and then you're supposed to be happy. And it's like what I figured out is I never actually got happy until I left that entire structure behind, took every cent that I owned, destroyed the 401k and pushed it all into everything that I ever thought was cool, which the first things were like water skiing, the North Woods. I started a paddleboard shop, like, And I went from making a bunch of money doing something I hated to making no money doing things I loved. And then like eventually all I can say is if you make these decisions to not go down the path that's being prescribed to you, but to make the decision to just like go after the things that you have passion for and let the chips fall where they may, I think what you'll find and what many, many people find is that if you can do that, the world will catch you in a way that will surprise you every single time. And the more you can let go of what you think you're supposed to do and just let sort of the winds of change push you in a certain direction and get your hook into something, like you said, in the consciousness space and artificial intelligence, but these things that are the bleeding edge of development, if you can find a way to get excited about some of those fast moving developments in technology or in culture, I think you'll find that your way of contributing value to those type of projects will manifest itself in front of you. This is what I've seen with BitTensor. Like I can't code for shit, but I can do a podcast, and in the space for the project, nobody was doing a podcast. So I've been wanting to do one for a long time. I tried to do one about the end of the world and how I think everything sucks. And I recorded one episode and I'm like, I can't fucking do this. You know, like there was no way I was like running out of fuel after 15 minutes of yelling into the microphone, you know? And so I found something I was passionate about. Started spending my time learning how to contribute to the ecosystem with the skills that I have. And even though I can't code, you know, I can make space for myself to do some valuable things to show people outside of the project that what's going on in it in a way that doesn't have a, you know, too many layers of technology layered on the communication. So people, you know, have a hard time understanding it. If I just explain to the level I can understand it, that tends to bring the average person on board with the project. And yeah, I think if you're a young person, that's great advice to kind of figure yourself out a little bit and then go out into the world and figure out where you can use your skill set that you've been developing in your life to make an impact in something that you care about. And hopefully you'll find your way. I think you will. Yeah. I think that kind of covers some of the things I wanted to talk about today, man. I love hearing you riff about artificial intelligence. I'm excited to hear who else you have on your podcast. I've been catching the episodes, the last few episodes you put up. A lot of them do have this like AI leaning, you know, coverage. Some of them do. So I would encourage anyone, if they're interested, also check out your AI Shamans podcast. There's only a couple episodes of it, but for me, like when I started playing those, that was what, reinvigorated me, I guess, to continue my relationship with you that we started, you know, 5 years ago at this point now. So thanks for the conversation today, Hamilton.
Yeah. Amazing conversation. Thanks so much, Keith. I look forward to many more. And, to everyone out there, just tap in. You got it. Follow your passions. Mine are consciousness, plant medicines, the future of the world as we know it, and the future of our technology. So find your passions and follow those. And Keith, thank you so much. I look forward to many more.
Thanks, man.